It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's a new way to say masterful in Chinese. Chinese food authority Grace Young introduces us to wok hei, meaning the perfect melding of energy and food, the ideal stir fry. And she tells us how to achieve it. Her book is The Breath of a Wok, Unlocking the Spirit of Chinese Wok Cooking. Well, the Sterns are into old-time Polish feasting at Milwaukee's Polonaise. Wine maven Andrea Immer tells us how to stock a wine closet on the cheap. The author of A Thousand Places to See Before You Die has three places to eat before you die. And then it's Gourmet Magazine's greatest hits. 60 years of gourmet recipes with food editor Zan Stewart. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Today we talk to a Chinese food authority who's gone where no expert's gone before. Grace Young has unearthed the story of China's famous pot, the wok, and she's dug into the paragon of wok skill, how to achieve wok hay, or the perfect stir fry. Her book is The Breath of a Wok. Andrea Immer has the clutch of wines that will go with anything you eat, and they are not pricey. The author of A Thousand Places to See Before You Die plucks out the three eating experiences we must know before going to that great buffet in the sky. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things started the way we do every week with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to you by Starbucks, a passion for the perfect cup. The Sterns write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, you know, Milwaukee is a city full of great Eastern European restaurants, and one of our favorites is one called Polonez. Needless to say, it's a Polish place.
That's what I would imagine. Yeah.
And it's one of those places, you know, you walk in and you are transported to the old world in every way, in terms of the setting, the accents on the people that you deal with, and most of all, the food, which is just gorgeous, delicious, old world cooking, as good as it gets.
What kinds of things are we talking about? I mean, when I think Poland, I think dumplings and goose. And am I nailing it?
Yes, you are.
Yes, you
I mean, of course you want pierogi, which
get. Oh, yeah.
You know, buttery. These are really buttery ones. And you can get them filled with, you know, with meat or
potatoes
or potatoes and cheese or sauerkraut. And they're, you know, you can get an appetizer portion of maybe, I think, four, or you can get a whole dinner's worth of
these.
And
they're boiled, which is fine, but I always think they look kind of naked. So
right.
Then you can get them pan-fried in a little butter.
So they get a little crust.
They get a little brown. Oh, it's so wonderful.
Now, the pierogi is sort of the Poland's, the Italian wannabe. They're a noodle dough, right? And then there's the fillings
or
going in.
Or a blintz, maybe?
Every culture has its version. I mean, you know, toasted ravioli is one.
Yeah, right. Or Szechuan dumplings or any
right.
I mean, whoever the genius was who thought of putting, you know, a tablespoon of something wrapped inside dough really was a genius, because it hopped from culture to culture to culture.
But, you know, that's just the beginning. I mean, there is a whole menu, as you know, roast goose, bigos, you know, which is the hunter's stew filled with all kinds of different meats. We went there on a Friday night, which, you know, as is true of every single restaurant in Milwaukee, is fish fry night, and had some of the most delicious lake perch served with lace-thin, crisp-edged potato pancakes to die for.
You know, I was a little nervous when we went to Polonez last time, because George Brzezinski, who is the chef, had written a short article, or I guess he was interviewed for Milwaukee Magazine, and he said how he had lightened up the old family recipes by using, you know, and I'm instantly, oh my God, not Nouvelle Cuisine Polish, but they really do taste delicious still, and they taste like they should.
What does this place look like?
It's how can I put this? It's much more formal looking than it actually is. The tables are covered with absolutely starched, clean white cloths. We were sort of early for our meal there, and as we got there, we watched a staff going around and polishing the salt and pepper shakers. I mean, just running a cloth around the sides of them to make sure there were no fingerprints on them. I mean, it's that neat and tidy and clean. And of course, there's all kinds of sort of Polish folk art decor to set the mood of the place.
Is it expensive?
Medium so. I think we had our fish fry, we had pierogi, we had slivovitz afterwards, you know, which is the brandy you have to have, the plum brandy afterwards. You know, a couple of full meals for, what, maybe $40.
Well, that's not bad.
Not bad at all. Or, you know, since Michael and I just got back from our first trip to London, $40 will buy you a cup of coffee if you're lucky. So, I mean, by comparison, this is cheap eats.
How about desserts? I mean, what kind of desserts do they do?
You want those, what do they call the crepes that you have? You know, palachinki, which you get filled either with sort of ground toasted nuts, or you can get a chocolate filling. My favorite is an apricot filling. The palachinki, which are thin crepes, are rolled around the apricot filling and then sprinkled with a little bit of powdered sugar. It's rich, eggy, and sweet.
I think, Michael, when we retire, we have to open a restaurant called Dough Wrapped Around Many Things, because it truly is my favorite cuisine.
You can open the restaurant and I'll just eat there.
Okay.
Hey, guys, thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Take care.
Whoop-dee-doo, whoop-dee-doo, I hear a polka and my troubles are through.
The Stearns are authors of that indispensable guide, Road Food. Now, they're here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, check out our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. Every week, we send you a new recipe, and we also send along shopping and technique tips. But best of all, thanks to those cows, it's free. You can register for it online, splendidtable.org. Oh, and we've got more news. We have wanderlust here at the Splendid Table, and we are going to Italy. We're taking a trip to my beloved Emilia-Romagna region this spring, and you can too. You can find the details of the trip on the website, splendidtable.org. I love the new way today's wine people are explaining the grape. I mean, esoteric information may be fascinating, but most of us need some simple logic to get us in and out of the wine shop. Now, one of the leaders in demystifying the grape is Andrea Immer. She's an award-winning sommelier, host of TV's Simply Wine, and she's author of Everyday Dining with Wine. Andrea, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You know, Andrea, we stock up the pantry so that, you know, we've got stuff to cook with or stuff to garnish with. How do you stock up your wine closet, you know, for everyday drinking?
Well, stocking up your wine closet for everyday drinking is really something that people should do for a couple of reasons. First of all, when you do it at one time, you can usually buy six bottles or even a case, or go in on a case with a friend and request from the store a mixed case discount. So you get your best prices.
Mm-hmm.
You can also shop when things are on sale. So I look at it and I break it down to a couple of simple categories that if you have them on hand, 90% of what you cook or order in will be perfect with these wines.
So how do they break out?
Well, let's start with whites, and let's start with the grape variety with which everybody is enamored, Chardonnay. It's the number one selling white in our country,
mm-hmm,
for good reason. It really ranges across the fruit spectrum from tangy and crisp to lush and tropical and exotic, and you can break it down into two categories, Chardonnay in what I call the unoaked, meaning it's never been aged in a barrel, versus Chardonnay in the oaked style, which has been aged in a barrel. When it's unoaked, it's crisp and refreshing. When it's barrel-aged, it's luscious and rich and full. So that one wine grape can range across all kinds of dishes from, you know, chips and salsa to the, you know, fanciest lobster bisque you can imagine putting together.
Which would go with the one that comes out of oak.
Exactly. The oak barrel-aged Chardonnays are really suited to fuller-bodied foods, and frankly so much so that that even carries them into red meat dishes, so you don't need to shy away. If you like white wine but you want to make, you know, steak tonight with a mushroom sauce, the fuller-bodied oak-aged Chardonnays will work for you, and then for lighter-bodied dishes, the unoaked style.
Now, is there anything on the label that tells me the difference?
Yes. Chardonnays, luckily the labeling on them is usually pretty good. Most of what you find from California, which is the biggest selling category in this country, is going to be the barrel-aged styles, but there are a couple of label terms to look for. On the front label, you may see either the words barrel-fermented or barrel-select or barrel-aged. Or look on the back label, and they very frequently say, this wine which was aged in oak barrels, and then you know.
Mm-hmm.
For unoaked styles, usually what you want to do is look towards France, and there are two region names on the label to focus on. One of them is called Macon, and it's spelled like the town of Macon in Georgia, M-A-C-O-N. And then the other one is very popular. It's called Puy-Fuissé, and that's also an unoaked style.
All right, another white.
Another white to look for, and this is really sort of getting trendy, another grape. It's the Sauvignon Blanc grape. And this is a beautiful one to pair with food because it has a lot of herbal and savory elements in the fragrance and the flavor that really match, especially a lot of ethnic style foods that we love to have, whether it's Mexican or Asian type fare.
Mm-hmm.
This is the wine for those. And right now I'm suggesting that people look to New Zealand, which is a great source for wonderful Sauvignon Blanc with not only this herbaceous character, but also beautiful tropical grapefruit and passion fruit kind of flavor. So even tasting it on its own, it really grabs your attention and kind of shakes up your taste buds. And you're still looking at a wine that's a $10 wine a lot of times. So good stuff.
Okay. So what do you stock up on when we talk about red wines?
For red wines, there's lots of choices, but my sort of two big picks are the Pinot Noir red grape, and for value choices, I look to Oregon. The Willamette Valley in Oregon makes wonderful Pinot Noirs for $15 and less. And then also to California, we've got fantastic Pinot Noir coming, not so much from Napa, which we've all heard of, but from some emerging areas like Monterey County and Santa Barbara County. And you'll see those regions listed right on the label and get some great Pinot Noir for the price. And then for a wine that's not labeled for the grape, go to Spain. Spain is really hot right now in the world of wine. And look for a region name. It's called Rioja. And you can find a particular designation on the label, the word crianza. And that means that the wine is just briefly aged, so it keeps lots of fresh sort of cranberry and cherry fruit. And then it's got that extra twist of Spanish style. They have a savory, spicy element to them that makes them wonderfully diverse, which is why it's the perfect pantry staple.
Now, what would you eat with, let's say, the Pinot Noir?
Pinot Noir is incredibly versatile. Sommeliers love it because you can recommend it no matter what people have ordered, and it'll probably go. So when you're feeling really, you know, sort of flummoxed because one person's got trout and the other one's got wild boar, you can do Pinot Noir, literally.
Uh-huh.
But it's fantastic with salmon, with tuna, and also with anything that's got like a lot of mushrooms in it.
Mm-hmm.
And also smoky dishes. Smoked fare is really great with Pinot Noir. And then for Rioja, I love it with things like pizza, barbecue, sort of that bold kind of
spicy.
Kicked up. Yeah.
Yeah.
That people love to eat.
So if you're kicking it up, you want to have the Rioja.
Exactly. And you're talking again about probably an $8.99 wine that will really make you happy.
Hey, Andrea, thanks.
Pleasure.
Andrea Immer's latest book is Everyday Dining with Wine. Now, you can find Andrea's recipe for coconut milk curry shrimp soup to serve with those Sauvignon Blancs on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, how to achieve wok nirvana and the three places to eat before you die. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find new takes on ethnic classics like salsa, chorizo, and black beans. Find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Say stir fry, and everybody knows what you mean. It's the same for the essential stir fry equipment, the wok. You may not own one, but you've heard the word. Well, considering that this pan comes out of one of the world's most complex cultures and that it's been around for a couple of thousand years, you'd think it had a story to tell. Interestingly, no Asian food expert has dug into what the wok is all about until now. Grace Young has written a book called The Breath of a Wok, Unlocking the Spirit of Chinese Wok Cooking Through Recipes and Lore. Grace, welcome back.
Thank you, Lynn.
This title is so intriguing, The Breath of a Wok and the Spirit of a Wok. What do you mean?
Right. I'm Cantonese. And when I was growing up, my father taught me that a stir fry in Cantonese should always have wok hay. Hay is the same word as you might be familiar with in Mandarin, which is qi, which is energy or breath.
Right.
So that's my translation of what wok hay is. It's a seared, coveted taste and aroma that only comes from a very, very hot wok when you stir fry.
Is this sort of the height of what a stir fry can be?
Yes, and I've always felt that the term stir fry is really misused and misunderstood in America. Nobody really tells you what the standard is for a great stir fry. And we have so many stir fries that come swimming in oil or with goopy sauces, but the Cantonese are the great masters, and when they do it in such a hot wok that the food cooks so quickly that it has this wonderful seared taste and aroma, and you preserve the nutrients. And to me, it has the essence, the energy in it, the breath, that you can actually feel the heat coming from the wok into the food.
It almost sounds, if you'll pardon me, it does sound a little spiritual.
So yes,
there's energy in that wok. Can we do this at home?
Of course, but I think people have never been told the correct wok to use for a home kitchen. And there are little tips that people need to know about correctly stir frying.
Well, okay, let's start with the wok itself. How do you buy a wok? What do you look for?
The good news is it's almost the most inexpensive. It needs to be carbon steel or Chinese-made cast iron, which is very different from an American cast iron skillet, which is so heavy. The Chinese cast iron is very lightweight, and so it's actually brittle, and if you banged it against a counter, it could shatter.
Uh-huh.
So either one of those are the best pans because they really heat up very quickly, and they retain the heat, unlike nonstick or stainless steel.
What's wrong with nonstick or stainless steel?
Nonstick, you'll never get that wonderful searing on your food.
Uh-huh.
You just can't do it. And most nonstick manufacturers tell you not to cook on high heat.
But then you can't get wok hay.
Exactly. And stainless steel is very uneven. So carbon steel and cast iron are really the best. There are various qualities of carbon steel. And what you want is a spun carbon steel wok. Those are the heavier ones, so that if you press in on the wok with both hands...
The sides of the wok, the lip of it.
The sides of the wok, yes. Thanks, Lynn. You can't push in. It should be that sturdy. And what I always recommend is a 14-inch wok, and that it should be flat bottom. And by flat bottom, I mean just a very, very small flatness on the bottom of the wok, maybe 5 inches in diameter. You don't want it to be bigger than 5 inches because then it's going to become almost like a skillet again. And you want that flat bottom so that it can sit closer to a Western stove. The problem with most Western stoves are that they don't get hot enough, and so your wok can't get hot enough.
Well, I'd like to talk about actually cooking in the wok. What are the two prime things that we should remember?
When you're stir frying, you must always heat the wok first. There's a rule called hot wok, cold oil. And if you put cold oil in a cold wok and heat it and add your food, I guarantee it will stick. But if you heat the wok, and the way you test how it's correctly heated is I put my hand about an inch away from the bottom of the wok, and it should feel like a hot radiator. The other test is flick a drop of water into the wok, and it should evaporate within about a second or two.
Okay.
Then you know the wok is hot enough. You don't want to overheat it and get out of control. So when it's hot enough, then I just take maybe 2 teaspoons, maybe a tablespoon of oil, swirl it into the wok, and then I rotate the pan to make sure it's totally coated on the bottom, and then I add the aromatics, ginger, garlic, whatever. And it should have a sizzling sound. And The more you cook with a seasoned carbon steel or cast iron wok, the more seasoned it becomes and the more nonstick it becomes. So you actually create a naturally nonstick pan.
Now, what's number two?
Number two is that I would say the biggest mistake people make is when they're stir frying vegetables, they put them in wet. And the moment you put in a wet vegetable, you're going to get a braise and not a stir fry.
Mm-hmm.
And in a 14-inch wok, you shouldn't put more than 4 cups of vegetables. That's the other problem, that people put too much.
Mm-hmm.
And then the wok, it completely cools down. So I put my greens into a salad spinner, like bok choy cut into 2-inch pieces.
Mm-hmm.
I just run it through the salad spinner to just knock out all that excess water.
Well, I feel like I can begin my own quest for wok hay now. Grace, thank you.
Happy stir frying, Lynn.
Thanks. Grace Young is co-author with Alan Richardson of The Breath of a Wok, Unlocking the Spirit of Chinese Wok Cooking Through Recipes and Lore. To capture wok hay, Grace wants us to start with a recipe, Lee Wan Ching's Chinese Broccoli with Ginger Sauce. Now you can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Mark Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, and many of our people need it sorely on that account. Well, this is from a new book I can't stop thumbing. It's called 1,000 Places to See Before You Die. It's by Patricia Schultz. Patricia, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's such an honor. Thank you, Lynn. I'm glad to be here.
The book is fascinating because you keep saying to yourself, I never knew about that. I never knew about that. But out of the 1,000 choices, I'd love for you to pluck out maybe 3 of the most fascinating ones. And I'd love them to be things we've probably never heard of before.
Okay. Just 3, right?
Yeah. I only because, you know, we've got to start someplace.
Well, you know, this morning I got an email from a friend of mine that went off to Cairo, and a little reluctantly given the situation of the world today, but he just went on and on. He's so in love with this place he had been to before. He said he found it just as welcoming. The hospitality of the Egyptian people is legendary and millennium old. And there's, you know, it has one of the best great world bazaars. The atmosphere is that sense of timelessness and antiquity, and people still go there to buy the dowries for their daughters and, you know, spices and the coal with which they rim their eyes. It's made from crushed olive pits. And within this, you know, cacophony and craziness and, you know, contained pandemonium is an oasis. It's my favorite place. I can't always find it, but when I do, it's such a respite. It's called El Fishawi. And it's been opened 24 hours, 24/7, as they say, since 1752. It's said to be.
What is it?
It's a coffee house. It's Cairo's most famous coffee and tea house. And it has that patina of the centuries and these old timers. Invariably, I'm the only female one there, but that's just fine. I actually feel very comfortable there. And they sit with their hookah pipes and they discuss whatever it is they're discussing so animatedly, probably soccer scores and, you know, this 7-year-old granddaughter who's watching too much MTV and Britney Spears. You know, who knows what they're saying, but it's just chock full of character and everything that's wonderful about Egypt.
Well, okay, what would be your second choice then?
You know, I think South America is so incredibly underrated. I don't understand why we're not flocking to South America. I did the whole Amazon thing once, which was truly like a year back at university. It was so fascinating. And at the mouth of the Amazon, in a city called Belém, which is Portuguese for Bethlehem, but in the city of Belém, there's one of the great port marketplaces in all of South America. It's Brazil's largest. And there's vegetables and produce and all kinds of voodoo, macumba, superstition-linked, you know, aphrodisiacs and amulets and lizard powder and dried boa constrictor. I mean, it's a bizarre thing.
Uh-huh.
But the wonderful thing is that from this bounty of everything that's grown in the Amazon basin comes this wonderful woman who has created a wonderful restaurant called La en Casa, which means there at home. And her name is Ana Maria, and I remember her so vividly. She's a wonderful person, creates the most mouth-watering food. Duck is one of her specialties. Piranha? Piranha, thank you, on the grill. Huh. Everything fresh from the market that morning, which means that it's hours old, and just an incredible experience.
What would be your choice in Asia?
Vietnam, things have changed enormously in Vietnam while not changing at all. Some of the beauty of visiting there is that the graciousness of the Southeast Asian people is everywhere evident. Hanoi is a favorite city of mine, the capital of French Indonesia for almost 70 years up until the mid-50s. And it retains that sense of elegance, a little, crumbling and decadent. But the tree-lined streets, boulevards are wide and lovely. And there's a renaissance going. And we had the concierge at the hotel jot down the name of this place called Chaka La Vong. And I'm probably not saying that right. But we handed it to the pedicab, the, trickshaw bicycle man. Mm-hmm. And his face just lit up. He had us understand that we were going to the best place in town. Seven decades, who knows how many, three or four generations, the Duan family has been making one dish only. It's a fried fish-based stew called Chaka. $10. It's a $1 million meal. The spices of Southeast Asia, a little dried chili pepper, and then poured over vermicelli rice noodles, and all there at your table. And at the next table is a family of 12 who are celebrating somebody's birthday. And it's the next table, there's a cardiologist from Chicago who's on to the same thing as you.
Such fascinating places. Hey, Patricia, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Lynn.
Patricia Schultz is author of 1,000 Places to See Before You Die. You can find Patricia's travel picks on the website, splendidtable.org. A couple of weeks ago, we taped a show on stage at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City. It was the kickoff to Gourmet Magazine's weekend of demos and seminars. They call it the Gourmet Institute. One of our guests that evening represented the unsung heroes of food magazines, the people who develop the recipes, doing them again and again to make sure that they work. I welcomed on stage Gourmet's executive food editor, Zan Stewart.
Good to see you. In your lap right now is a very thick yellow book. This is the new cookbook, and it's a true tome. This is called The Gourmet Cookbook, and it's about 60 years of Gourmet Magazine, from 1941, more or less, until a couple of years ago.
Yes.
Now, how did you come up with, I know it's about 1,000 dishes, but I'm thinking about what was in that magazine for 60 years. How did you choose 1,000 dishes? How did you boil it down?
It was so hard. We started with a wish list. We started with a database of 50 or 60,000 recipes. But there were many duplications. In 63 years of publishing a food magazine, we've published more than one apple pie. There have been a couple of chocolate mousses.
Yeah, I would imagine.
And so it came down to trying to remember which was the best chocolate mousse. Well, and then we would have arguments. And this happened in category after category. I mean, every pea soup was suddenly, under a different kind of scrutiny.
Well, I think of Gourmet Magazine from 1941 as being a chronicle in many ways of eating in America. But didn't it begin as being mainly about French food, rather very spiffy, upscale French food? Am I remembering correctly?
Lynn, I'm glad you asked that, because that is the perception, and it really was. It was definitely an Epicurean magazine, lifted pinky intended. Mm-hmm. However, we published recipes for guacamole and chili con carne in 1941. I mean, there were Chinese recipes, Japanese recipes, all through the 40s. It was not limited to French. Mm-hmm. It was assumed, because the word gourmet was used, that it was all French. And they certainly didn't scorn French. It was favored, but it wasn't all French all the time.
Well, since it does cover such a long period,
Can you give us a little hit parade? I mean, what were some of the outstanding dishes?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, there, you know, this, I've been on the road touring for the book, and people ask me, what's my favorite recipe out of 1,283 recipes? I mean, there are many more than one. Mm-hmm. But I thought it might be fun just to talk about a few of them by decades. The book isn't organized by decade. It's organized as a normal cookbook would be by appetizers and soups. But just to kind of go back, to the 40s, we, you know, we have a recipe for umaki, which is something that, you know, my mother adored. I mean, that was a real standard cocktail party.
Why don't you explain what it is? Because I think a lot of people know.
Umaki is chicken livers next to a little slice of water chestnut. They were canned water chestnuts in those days, often marinated with a little bit of sherry, and then wrapped in bacon and broiled. And on a little wooden pick.
Yeah. And boy, they were good.
Very, very good. Very good. Vichyssoise. The man who invented vichyssoise, Louis Diat, a French chef, was at the Ritz-Carlton, and we published it in the 40s, and the recipe that he published in Gourmet magazine is the recipe that we ran. It ran unchanged. It's perfection.
These foods are still tasting great. This is the other thing.
They didn't all taste great, but many of these did. I mean, lobster Newburgh was another epiphany. We thought, you know, I mean, do we even want to dust this off? It's probably going to be so stodgy, so rich, so over the hill. And, you know, two tastes, and it was all sharp elbows around the tasting table. I mean, it got to be very, very intense.
Well, what about the 60s?
The 60s. You know, one of the things that seemed to bridge the hippie movement with the bridge club was poppy seed dressing. Remember that?
Yeah.
It was just, you know, that was just one of those kind of innocuous.
So from the bridge club to the hippie movement, and it's
the
poppy seed.
The mother and daughter that were no longer speaking. You know, we're probably each serving poppy seed dressing, and they're, you know, one in the commune and the other one at home.
Tell me that the 70s were Beef Wellington.
No, the 60s were really Beef Wellington, but we didn't like the recipe. We published a recipe for Beef Wellington in the 50s. We didn't like that recipe, so we updated it in the 90s. The recipe that's in the book is a much, much better version. But, you know, the pasta primavera, mm-hmm. Sergio Maccione at Le Cirque invented this dish, pasta primavera. It took New York by storm. You couldn't have a dinner party in the 70s without making pasta primavera. Mm-hmm. It was mandatory. But there was also goat cheese, the warm goat cheese salad, and spinach and bacon salad. Every single Fern bar and singles bar in Manhattan had spinach and bacon salad. So we've got that too.
Well, I want to get the next chapter, but I think I'm going to get the book. Zen, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Zan Stewart is executive food editor of Gourmet Magazine. Now, you can get that rumaki recipe Zan talked about on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, believe it or not, Gourmet Magazine started in the early 1940s, the war years, World War II. Food rationing was rampant. Now, here's our question. During food rationing, what kitchen staple was treasured for ammunition? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question goes back to the beginning of Gourmet Magazine. Believe it or not, it started in the early 1940s, the war years during World War II. Now, the question was, during the war's food rationing, what kitchen staple was treasured for ammunition? Well, the answer is fat, as in drippings, and butter. Fat was used to make glycerin for explosives. Now, one of Gourmet's competitors, Better Homes and Gardens magazine, said this to their readers in November of 1943. Do not squander drippings. Pour every dinky drop into a covered dish and store in the refrigerator. Use it for seasoning and shortening. Can't use it all? Pass it on for ammunition. I just wonder, if everybody was on a fat-free diet back then, would we have won the war? The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Who has been waiting patiently? We have got Kate on the line from Metamora, Michigan. Hey, Kate, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about herb jellies.
Oh, okay.
And I was on vacation last summer on Block Island off the coast of Rhode Island, and they have a wonderful farmer's market. And this lady was selling basil jelly. And I bought, just kept buying it and buying it and using it all week long.
Wiped her out.
And now I'm home and I'm trying to recreate basil jelly, but it gets kind of murky and light.
Did it have leaves in it?
No.
It was
clear and green and lovely.
Now, what have you been doing?
I've been doing just basically taking the mint recipe off the Sure Gel package.
Right.
And then trying to recreate it with basil.
Okay, and I don't know what the mint recipe is about.
It's basically you infuse it. You boil the water, and then you infuse the crushed mint leaves together.
And then you add pectin and sugar.
And sugar.
Right.
And you do the basic canning thing.
And it comes out not tasting as fresh and bright as hers?
Yes.
This is the problem with herbs when you're going to do something like a jelly, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you cook them in any way for any length of time, what's going to happen is that they just get murky and mushy. The flavors do.
Totally.
This is the thing I think you need to do. First of all, you want a ton of really flavorful basil. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I would say 2 cups basil to 2 cups water. Is that close to what you're doing?
Yes.
It is.
Yes.
3 cups basil to 2 cups water.
Okay.
Now, bring the water to the boil. Tear the basil leaves, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to even chop them. Just tear them with your hands.
Mm-hmm.
Bring the water to a boil. Drop in those leaves. Cover the pan and let it sit for 10 minutes.
Okay.
And then strain it.
And then strain it.
Right. Because you don't want the leaves in there for so long that they're going to actually, I can't explain it, but get cooked.
Yeah.
And then what I would do is take a small amount of water to melt the quantity of sugar that you might need. 2 cups maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It depends. And also lemon juice. Are you adding any acid to this?
No, I didn't last time. And that probably is.
Acid points up flavor, let's say if we have 3 cups of basil leaves, I would do 2 tablespoons of lemon juice that I would stir in toward the very end,
Great.
Melt the sugar and the water, maybe another 1/2 cup of water, add the pectin, and then add the herb water and let it all come together.
Idea
is I'm trying not to cook the basil too long. Now, this is going on a very, this is a memory from a long time ago.
No, this is great.
I mean, I'd start out with a small quantity and see if it's going to work. And the other thing is, I know it's terrible to tell you this at this time of year, but usually the younger the basil, the sweeter it is. So if a plant is about 6 inches high, you've got really young leaves and they tend to be super sweet. This time of year, they can tend to be very minty and sometimes even bitter. if they're older, you know, if they're really mature plants. Yeah. It may be not a bad idea to wait until next spring,
no,
but I'd say give it a shot now. If
I'll
you
give
get
it
the
a
basil.
Shot anyway.
Yeah. Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
You take,
take care,
Kate.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You know, this whole idea of infusing, it's a great way to cook. And by the way, you've got great herbs. I don't care what it is. You know, basil, rosemary. Infuse them in cream and then drain off the cream. Throw in black pepper, add a few eggs, and bake it as a baked custard. And you can serve it at room temperature. And it would be wonderful. You know, a great treat instead of a mashed potato. And come to think of it, not high in carbs. You got the fat, but that's another issue. You can call us, guys, 800-537-5252. Who's up next? We have got Eliza. She's in Marshalltown, Iowa. Hey, Eliza, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
On the 21st is my 14th birthday.
Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. And the theme I'm doing is Greece.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if you have some good ideas for Greek food.
Oh, boy. Oh, there's a ton of stuff. There's a... Now, how many people are you having?
Eight.
Okay. Is it like going to be a sleepover?
Yeah.
Okay. You know what? Oh, there's a ton of stuff. Okay. First of all, you can take yogurt, okay, and you can make like a yogurt cheese. That means all you do is you take a clean kitchen towel, you line a sieve, put it over a bowl, dump a quart of yogurt in that.
Okay.
Put it in the refrigerator, forget about it overnight.
Okay.
And what you get is a really thick, fresh cheese. Now, if you mix into that fresh mint, a lot of fresh dill and garlic, you've got a great dip for pita bread.
Okay.
Okay, and it's got to be plain yogurt. Obviously, if you know, if you use strawberry yogurt, it's going to taste awful.
Yeah.
The other, now, there's lots of stuff. Do you and your friends like vegetables?
Yes.
Because in Greece, vegetables are more important than meat. So, chickpeas from a can. Okay, they're also sometimes called garbanzos.
Mm-hmm.
What you're going to do is you're going to toss them with olive oil and garlic and some canned tomatoes and some fresh basil, and you're going to put them in a baking dish and put them in a 350-degree oven for about 30 minutes. And when you take them out, they're going to be concentrated and utterly delicious. And then you can put a few of them, not all of them, half of them, put them in the food processor or the blender. So you want to make this real chunky dip.
Mm.
It's so good. Slice up cucumbers. Sprinkle them with fresh mint, lemon juice, olive oil, and some feta cheese. Makes a fabulous cucumber salad.
Okay.
Then what I would do is I'd have a lot of vegetables that you could use for dipping, to put things on. So I'd have sliced carrots, I'd have sliced cucumbers, I'd have raw zucchini, because these things will all be like dips.
Okay. Okay.
You know, then the other thing, if you want, now you want some meat? Shall we throw some meat in here?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, you're going to take some lamb, preferably from the leg,
mm-hmm.
cut it into about 1-inch squares, and you're going to toss it with garlic, olive oil, lemon juice, and dry oregano. Now, this is the classic way that lamb is done in Greece. And you put it in the fridge overnight so it marinates. And then what you can do is you thread it on skewers.
Oh, kebab?
Yeah, and it's fabulous. And you can serve that right on top of the cucumbers with the feta and the mint. It's an unbelievable combination. So that's the basic idea. And then you could have olives around. And, you know, you can buy in some stores stuffed grape leaves in cans from Greece, and they are dynamite.
Mm.
And stuffed grape leaves are great. They have rice in them and nuts and all kinds of great stuff.
Okay.
Does that sound okay?
That sounds absolutely delicious.
Yeah, and then you might be able to get your hands on, in some stores, like a Greek dessert like baklava.
I love baklava.
If you can get your hands on that, that's your dessert. Otherwise, a lot of fresh fruit.
Thank you.
You take care and have a ball.
I will.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Now, we got a wine question via email recently, and I think it's really timely. The question was, if a wine tastes terrible, can I still cook with it? I hate to waste money. Well, I hate to waste money, too, but using lousy wine in your food will waste even more money. It'll ruin the dish. I learned this the hard way, by the way. The key is that when you cook with wine, you usually reduce it down to an essence. So if the wine is bad, you get concentrated bad. Now, there is one exception. If the wine tastes like it's turning to vinegar, try it in salad. But if it tastes rotted or musty, ditch it. Anyway, 800-537-5252. Let's see who is next. We've got Mark calling from Portland, Oregon. Mark, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hello. I love to cook, but I usually find each week with going to the store and getting fresh food that at the end of the week I'm throwing out a lot of produce that's gone bad.
Well, welcome to my house.
And so I'm exactly. So I'm interested in kind of the food science of maintaining good produce and meat and preventing spoilage in the refrigerator.
What a great question.
And I know the refrigerator, or at least mine, is divided into different areas. And, of course, at the bottom I've got a meat drawer and I've got a vegetable crisper. And I've put thermometers in those to check various temperatures. And I'm wondering what's the ideal kind of temperature for different kinds of foods.
Okay, this is the way it works, and this is a great question. And also there's another key to this as well with produce. But the way it works generally is, and you're on the right track, you really should check this occasionally with a thermometer. You want generally to your refrigerator to be between about 33 and 37 or 38 degrees. Okay? In so many words, just above freezing and not at 40.
Okay.
All right. That's the best range. Now, vegetables and produce tend to do better at the higher end of that range. So let's say 36, 37, maybe at the very most 40. Dairy, meat, almost everything else does best at the lowest end of the range. That's the whole deal. And that those crisper drawers are usually in a place where it's just a tad warmer than it is where you would have your dairy or where you would put your meat. And often the meat drawer even has its own little thing in it that helps keep it cold.
Exactly.
But now let's go into how is the stuff packaged? If you are storing anything that's leafy or green, I would say this, in fact, about any produce and any fruit. What it doesn't want is moisture and air. So the things that you want to do is you want to seal out all the possible moisture and all the possible air. Now, the opposite is true of fresh meat. If you take meat as it comes from the supermarket, still wrapped, and you stick it in the refrigerator, yeah, it'll hold. But the deal is you want to have some air circulating around that meat. So generally, unless you can hold it more than a day or so, I open the wrapper.
Okay.
You know, and I actually sometimes, if it's a steak sitting on one of those styrofoam things,
right,
I'll flip it over and I'll just let it sit in the meat drawer or even on a shelf, on a cold shelf, with just air able to get around it. Yeah, it might get a little dark on the surface, but the reality is I'm giving it more refrigerator life because bacteria doesn't develop. So think produce, no air, no moisture. Think meat, you want to have air, meat, poultry, et cetera, you want to have air circulating around it.
Okay.
Okay?
That sounds great.
All right.
This will help.
This will definitely help. And also, when I said welcome to my life, our eyes feast sometimes more than our mouth can possibly keep up with.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, and so tempting to stock up with stuff. Anyway, thanks for a great question.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Enjoy the show.
Hey, thank you. Well, we have this problem. Obese school kids who, like most of us, love to snack, and in almost every school, there are vending machines spilling out candy bars and chips. Now, an extra kink here is schools need the income from those machines. Well, this conundrum has food purveyors scrambling for solutions. One is Stonyfield Farms yogurt. Now, we have Stonyfield Farms CEO Gary Hertzberg on the line. Gary, thanks for talking with us.
Nice to be here, Lynn.
So what is Stonyfield doing at this point?
Well, I have three little yogurt eaters myself, and of course, like most parents, I have the six-hour blind spot every day when they go to school. I discovered a couple of years ago that my son's favorite lunch was pizza, chocolate milk, and Skittles. Of course, I didn't realize Skittles was a food group. And when I went to talk to the school nutritionist about it, she said very bluntly, not maliciously, she said, "We love what you do, we love your yogurt, but if it's healthy, the kids won't eat it." So we just set out to sort of slay that dragon. What we've done is we've put 25 vending machines around the country filled with organic and natural snacks in urban schools, rural schools, suburban schools, high school, middle school, just to sort of prove that that was not the case. And we've proven it in spades. We're selling just you know, we're just giving away the product, but we're selling between 50-60% of what a Coke or Pepsi machine sells at. So we've certainly turned a lot of minds.
Oh, no, wait, what's actually in the machines?
Well, it's, of course, yogurt smoothies. There's everything from raisins to wasabi beans. There's soy nuts, cheese sticks, fruit. What we do is when we go into the schools, we actually have the kids sample products in kind of a fair for a day. And they will pick from about 30 or 40 products, depending on the school, down to the 15 or so that they're going to carry. And, you know, we find that if it's delicious, kids will eat it.
See, I've always thought you give a kid a Reese's cup and then you try to sell them on a cup of yogurt and it just isn't going to work. So, I mean, it actually is working? Are you making?
It is. Well, the fun part is you'll get these. I've had two wonderful quotes. One is the senior in high school who's been taking 4 years of nutrition and health classes saying that when I leave class, I know all about the food pyramid. I know exactly what to eat. But when I come into the lunchroom after class, it's nothing that matches what I just learned in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
The other is the athletes who are well-educated these days about building strong bones and keeping their weight under control and reducing the amount of junk. And again, they are starving for something that's consistent with the diets their coaches and trainers tell them to eat. So, you know, it's one of these very simple things. If you build it, they will come. And we just have to decide that it's important enough to start building these things.
Well, Gary, thank you.
My pleasure, Lynn. Thanks for your interest.
Gary Hertzberg is CEO of Stonyfield Farms. Now, for more information on how to sign up your school for the vending machine program, go to our website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. So until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Lao Tzu, written in 550 BC. He said, "Ruling a big country is like cooking a small fish. Too much handling can ruin it." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for our free newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, made possible by Organic Valley, an independent cooperative of family farmers bringing fresh milk, juice, butter, eggs, and cream to your local supermarket every day. More information available online at organicvalley.com. Additional support for our program comes from Starbucks. From coffee farmer to their roasters to your barista, craft, creativity, and passion are poured into every cup. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.